Moving into the meeting itself, the first item on the agenda is the adoption of the minutes of the April 12, 2012 meeting in Miami. Do I hear a motion for their adoption?
I move adoption.
Do I hear a second? Is there a second?
A second.
Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, the minutes refer to the fact that I spoke and the board had voted to put the draft consolidation report on the website in the minutes. And it's my understanding that not all of the consolidation report was put on the website. The part relating to salaries for the grantee heads was deleted or not put on. Am I correct in that understanding, or page 28, or am I mistaken?
Does somebody from management have a...
Yes, I have part of the answer. Yes, there were two graphs that were excised due to sensitivities. That was a management-level decision.
Well, my question is, since the board voted to put it on, why did it not come back to the board as to why at least one page as it relates to salaries? I assume it's salaries. And by the way, I should point out these salaries are available on the IRS 990 form. I mean, if anyone is curious to know what Libby Lou, Steve Korn, or Brian Conov make, they need only pull out the 990 form with IRS, and there it is. So why would you take it up? Why would we do this? One, why would we do it? And two, what after the board directed it be done, why was 98% of what the board directed done and this portion was deleted and we weren't told about it?
Governor, I assume that there was a sensitivity because of the salaries and a decision was made at the senior staff level, which I signed off on, to perhaps save some embarrassment because it was not only the director's salaries but other senior and middle manager salaries that were involved, and it was totally pre-decisional.
My question is, why didn't you, with the board having voted to do it, why didn't you at least advise us of this or come back to us?
Yep, we should have. If you'd like, we could still put it on, Governor.
Can I say something? This is Libby from RFA. We did ask, and Libby from RFA, can you hear me?
Libby Lou is speaking from RFA in Washington, and she has some added information, Governors.
One of our concerns at RFA was that having the benefit, especially comparison information for the whole organization, on the website might affect our union negotiations, which we are going to renegotiate our collective bargaining agreement. So we thought it was not appropriate to have that. And we noted that it was not published on the BBG Watch, therefore it was not already in the public space.
President of RFA said that one of the concerns that she has at Raider Free Asia is that if we put benefit information about other companies inside of U.S. International Broadcasting on the website, which is not public information, that somehow that would adversely affect the company's negotiations with labor unions, since that information is not made public. I do concur with you that as public employees, everybody's salaries eminently some are eminently findable. I am sympathetic to President Liu's point of in the middle of negotiations.
Well, perhaps we can offline find a solution that's acceptable to Governor Ash. And also be respectful of the need for confidentiality and embarrassment. So is that all right with you, Governor Ash?
Well, Mr. Chairman, here's my concern. I think Mrs. Lou makes some valid points, but I have a problem with the board votes to do something. It's like the discussion we had on Burma an hour ago. We vote to do something that doesn't happen. All I'm saying is there may come up to be very valid reasons as to why something didn't happen. Well, but someone ought to share them with the board and let us know. Now, Mr. Lobo apologized for not doing it, and I accept his apology. All I'm saying is it shouldn't happen again. Secondly, that portion of the salaries that's available on the IRS 990 is available to anyone on this planet Earth that wants to go to the Internet and pull it up, including benefits, including bonuses. So why would we eliminate? I mean, the labor union can see that. Now, if there are other salaries at a lower level that are not included, that's another issue.
Well, I think your point is well taken.
It's right there.
Okay.
So why are we hiding it?
I think we'll work.
And what's confidential about it? There is nothing confidential about what Steve Korn makes, Libby Lou makes, or Brian Conniff.
Okay.
It might not be enough, but it's not confidential.
All right. With that understanding that we'll work to make the information that should be available, it's moved and seconded that the minutes of April 20th be approved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. We're going to approach things on the agenda a little bit differently today to recognize the importance of the work that's being done, the actual substantive work that's being done by our broadcasters. We're moving the reports of the heads of the networks forward in the agenda. So at this time, I'd like to call on the Office of Cuban Broadcasting Director Carlos Garcia Perez to make a short report.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
I hope this becomes the standard in the future, and that, I mean, otherwise these folks are going to get shortchanged.
Well, they did get shortchanged last time.
And I would hope in the future, because we have as a board more interaction with Mr. Lowe and Mary Jean Buehler and others, and less with the grantees and Mr. Enzer. And while he's not here today, I would hope what's point B on here the governance committee might consider whether or not this should be the regular order in the future.
Happy to do that. Carlos Garcia Perez.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And I want to thank the board for allowing me to have a short notice closed session. I know it was a governor's briefing session this morning, but it was very important for me to be able to inform certain things that we're doing here at the Martiz. I want to be very brief, but I want to start by thanking Governor Anders Wimbush for his tremendous help, leadership, and helping the Martiz to develop the strategy that's in place today. He came down to Miami at least twice outside of regular meetings to help us develop and set forth our strategy, which is in place today. And I'm very happy to report, as the board knows, that's been very successful. We've been able to execute it on it. I think I'm not discarding the other folks that have helped us. Governor Meehan has been part of the strategic committee too, and I think others have been very helpful. But Anders took the time to come down here on separate meetings to help us develop the strategy that is in place today, and that we're very happy with the way it's been executed and with the strategy. So that's my first report. Second report is another thank you to Undersecretary Sunshine and Nick for helping us with a certain license that we have been trying to get for a while. The license is in place now, and we're trying to establish all the proper procedures to execute on it. This license will turn around, and it's a sea changer, and I'm stealing a quote from Tish King on the way we have been doing business for the last 27 years. So I really want to thank the Undersecretary and her staff for helping us in achieving this license. It was in place. I think they gave it a little push. And last but not least, this is like a thank you report. I also want to thank Susan Andrews. Susan Andrews, I heard yesterday she's going to retire from the BBG. Susan Andrews has been tremendous with our initiatives of communication on the Hill. I still remember my first board meeting. I wasn't even hired, and we all agreed that I had to be up in the Hill speaking with all the staffers, representatives, and senators. And Susan Andrews has done a tremendous job helping me meet with all those folks, and she's got tremendous credibility with the staffers and the representatives on the Hill. So I'm for one. I'm going to miss her tremendously, so I want to make sure that...
Anything else other than thanks? We can move along.
Yeah, I got my report, and we can go to the tape.
Alan, we have questions.
That's it. I'm done, Dennis. We can play the tape.
Wait a minute. There are questions. Hold on.
I thought you said you had a report.
Well, that was his report, apparently.
Was that the report?
That is my report. My report's on video. I just want to make sure that I thank these three folks.
The report's on.
So we can go to the tape.
Well, I think he's showing some programming highlights. Did you have questions?
Well, I haven't seen the video. Is the video likely to trigger some inquiry? I mean, it's hard to ask questions on a video you haven't seen.
Well, I think that
I don't know if they're going to ask questions. If there's going to be questions or not, I'd like to play the video, and I'll be more than happy to answer any questions.
Oh, so it's the program, Mr. Chairman, to play the video, and then if a board member has a question, we know.
Why don't we play the video, and then if there are questions, yes. Why don't we play the video?
On the coattails of Pope Benedict XVI's visit to Cuba, the topic of religion and Cuba continue to go hand in hand. Invited by the Cuban Archdiocese, Cuban Americans returned to the island for a conference. Meanwhile, Cuban Archbishop Jaime Ortega's visit to Harvard University unleashed a wave of controversy, and Radio Martí celebrated a birthday. On April 19th in Cuba, the church sponsored a conference on the topic of Cuban immigrants and invited Cuban-American academics back to the island.
To improve the relationship between Cuba and the Cuban diaspora.
1 week later, Cardinal Jaime Ortega, Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Havana, spoke at Harvard University. Answering questions from reporters, he referred to a group of 13 men and women who occupied a church in Havana as criminals of low cultural level, whose actions were part of a plan set from Miami. His words ignited a series of reactions in Cuba and abroad. A Martí editorial addressed the controversy and received widespread support, sparking a healthy debate amongst Cubans on the island. While elements of the Catholic Church in Cuba sided with the Archbishop, dissidents such as Oswaldo Payá, a prominent critic of the Castro government, engaged directly with the church, criticizing it on the same grounds as the Martí editorial. Well-known opposition leader and ex-political prisoner Dr. Oscar Elias Beset wrote an article and called the cardinal's words traumatic and described the church's occupants as peaceful and patriotic. Avanza Cuba, or Cuba Forward, the popular radio and TV Martí program, also focused on the role of religion in a free society in a post-Castro Cuba. In May, TV Martí followed Mariela Castro Espín, Raúl Castro's daughter, and Fidel's niece as she made her way from San Francisco to New York City. Castro was the director of Cuba's National Sex Education Center and was in the U.S. to speak about gay rights. Castro didn't shy away from talking politics. Her controversial visit didn't go without protests from Cuban Americans. This group was denied access to her events and kept at a distance by local authorities. MartiNoticias.com teamed up with Radio Liberty and covered the elections in Russia. The website collaborated with VOA in Havana and illustrated every detail of the Cuban Biennale. A MartiNoticias.com report shed light on a connection between Swedish furniture maker IKEA and Cuban prison labor. The investigation by Cuban blogger Jorge Luis Garcia was based on the information found in the old East German Stasi archives. The Martís had extensive coverage of the controversy, including reaction by Cuban Americans in the House and Senate. May also brought the return of the annual Cuba Nostalgia Festival to Miami. The three-day gathering celebrates Cuba's culture and glorious past. This year, Cuba Nostalgia marked the 110th anniversary of Cuba's independence. That same date, May 20th, coincided with the very first Radio Martí broadcast 27 years ago.
I've been here 26 and a half years, and after all those years, the greatest thing I've seen is the analytics that have come about recently through social media, where we're actually able to measure our audience. So while we have new tools to work with, we're still doing the same thing we were doing 27 years ago, and that's providing Cuba with fair and balanced news and information.
Thank you, Carlos. Carlos, can you
hear me? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's my report.
Let me see if there are. I think maybe Governor Ash has a question.
My question, Mr. Garcia, is along the lines which I've asked before, basically just to have an update. As you aware, you inherited, all of us did, the legal action that was brought under your predecessor, or maybe two predecessors back, in regard to some people that were riffed and let go by previous action. And the Labor Relations Board and the court, I believe, ruled against OCB, and that's now been appealed. And where does that stand in terms, because, as you know, I raised some questions without taking sides on whether I think it should be appealed or not appealed, it does represent a roll of the dice in terms of the financial consequences to the board and to the American taxpayer if the appeal fails. And the appeal may take 2 to 3 years, and the exposure may be in excess of $3 million, because if you lose on the appeal, you add 3 more years of interest, late charges, attorney fees, the whole bit. And I know it, and you all indicated in a prior case that the panel that will initially hear this, you expect to lose in, and then you would go into federal court. And have you been to the panel yet? If so, what's happened? If not, when is it scheduled? And thirdly, do you have to get Department of Justice and the Solicitor General's approval in order to take it into a federal court?
Governor, if Paul Comodorsi is with you guys, I'd like to defer that to him. I'm not extremely familiar with the process. I know that it's an ongoing process and that we are appealing the process, but if Paul can help me out with I would appreciate it.
Thank you, and I'll be very brief. We did disagree with the arbitrator's decision. Yes, I'd be happy to. We filed exceptions with the arbitrator's decision with the Federal Labor Relations Authority. We have not heard back from them.
When would you anticipate they have to hear your appeal?
It's a written appeal. It's not a hearing. It's a written appeal. It's all it's brief. There's no hearing, and we don't know when we'll hear back from them.
All right. Once the decision's made, whichever way it might go, does either party, the losing party, have a right to appeal that to another level?
I guess we would make an assessment at the time.
I didn't say whether you will. I said, do you have the right to?
I would have to, it would probably depend on the type of decision that they make, whether we would or we wouldn't. I don't have sufficient, expertise sitting right here to talk about this, but I'd be very happy to brief you offline about this case. And I believe that we actually have at one point in time in the past, but we'd be happy to provide another briefing.
Well, just for the benefit of my colleagues, we have discussed this in the past, but that was many months ago, and time has gone by, and this is an issue I think is of importance because there's a several $1 million exposure out there that this board could be hit with, and at a time when you're being, we're wrestling with recommendations to make, tough choices to make, I think we all need to be alert to the fact that this is there, and I am a little bit surprised that you apparently can't answer whether or not either party has the right to appeal. Obviously, the content of the decision would determine whether you want to appeal, and that's a wise judgment for the other side. But surely you would know if you could.
Briefly, because we do have a long agenda. And
I have a question, too.
This is a Federal Labor Relations Authority.
I know you and Mr. Corn are talking back and forth, and maybe he's your attorney on this.
Yeah, I think it's better if I just to answer offline.
Susan, you had a question.
Yeah, I do. If I could jump in, it sounds like, Paul, maybe you and Governor Ash need to have a sidebar on this particular issue. But thank you, Carlos, for that highlight reel. And Governor Ash, I agree with you. I would love to see the portion with the entity heads and our directors at the front end of our board meetings reporting on content and progress, because that's why we're all here. But specifically, Carlos, there was one little clip in that reel that talked about a partnership with Radio Liberty and Voice of America. Can you tell me that, how that came about and how it worked?
Well, it's something, I'd be glad to, Governor McHugh. It's something that we do more and more, and when there's an event that we think is going to be relevant to our audience, we call our colleagues on VOA or any of the other entities, and we share content, and a lot of times they even lead us to some of their stringers that they have in these particular countries, and they work with us. So it's a huge help, and it really helps us generate good content. So it's basically picking up the phone and calling the pertinent party and tell them what is it that we need, and 100% of the time we get full cooperation.
That's great.
Very good. Thank you very much. Moving on, I'd like to ask the president of RFERL, Steve Korn, to make his report.
To the VOA director.
Oh, I'm sorry. I went out of order. So why don't we go to, oh, sorry, we'll go to VOA, and then we'll go to RFERL.
Thank you very much, Governor. Yes,
David,
Steve Reddish.
Go ahead.
Yes, David Ensor is on travel, and I will fill in for him as briefly as possible. And I thought I'd start with David's trip. There's a photo that I would like to show where he is signing a breakthrough agreement with the Director General of the Myanmar State Radio and Television to place VOA English teaching programs on Burmese terrestrial radio stations. Under the agreement, the radio network will carry VOA four-minute feature reports three times a week. We're hoping it's a first step to a greater cooperation down the road on both radio and television. Our Burmese service chief, Luin Than, and IBB's Doug Boyton were there with David. He also held talks with Burmese Minister of Information, who expressed his support for greater access to his country, including his decision to issue multiple entry visas for VOA reporters. Before going to Burma, and we have another photograph, David had a stopover in Thailand, where he met with Bangkok Bureau employees, and went to Cambodia, where he and the Khmer service chief, Chris Deckard, met with VOA stringers and dropped by the RFA office and visited with U.S. and Cambodian officials. In this picture, you'll see David sitting as he listens to a Cambodian Buddhist monk during his visit to a stupa, which houses the remains of victims of the Khmer Rouge regime at a former detention center. One of the other big stories that we have been covering at VOA is Syria. It's a huge story, obviously, for MBN, but it's also one of the most important stories for VOA audiences in Iran, as well as those who speak Kurdish and our English language audiences. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett managed to get into Syria early in May to produce a series of radio, TV, and internet reports. A stringer from London, Henry Ridgewell, also produced several TV reports from the Syria-Turkish border. Scott Bob, our Jerusalem correspondent, was in Lebanon, and he was there when pro- and anti-Syrian factions in Lebanon began clashing in Tripoli and Beirut. And not long ago, a VOA Persian team composed of Rudy Bakhtiar, Siavash Sanditian, and Afshin Naraman went to the Turkish-Syrian border, where they got a first-hand look at the Syrian exodus triggered by the violence there. They went to several refugee camps and produced a video, and I've got about a minute and a half's worth of video that I'd like to show. So roll the video.
Reyhanlı refugee camp in Turkey, home to over 3,000 refugees, many of them children. The Turkish government provides the basics, a school, a playground, even some modest toys. At first glance, the children seem happy and playful, but inside these small tents they now call home, the reality of their lives is much harder to hide. 13-year-old Sarah is from Homs, the focus of an intense military crackdown for months. She says shelling destroyed her home.
There was blood all over the place. The regime started killing people because they thought they were armed.
Mustafa Harmoush is the nephew of General Harmoush, one of the first defectors of Bashar Assad's army, who was later kidnapped, brought back to Syria, and forced to confess on national television. Mustafa's other uncle was found tied to a tree, gutted like an animal.
They arrested my uncles, and they killed my uncles.
The United Nations says over 400 children have been killed and hundreds injured since the violence began last year. But there is no way to measure the psychological scars of the brutality these children have witnessed, painfully evident, not just in their faces, but in their drawings, in their playing, and even in their dreams.
What do you want to do when you grow up?
The children did that for me.
Turned out to be a soldier to protect Syria.
Rudy Bakhtiar, Rayhan Lee, Turkey, Voice of America.
And as we all know, the situation has gotten much worse in Syria and along the border in Turkey where the refugees are. I'm going to close with a photograph. Syria's got a significant Kurdish-speaking population, and our Kurdish service provides daily coverage of Syria. This picture was posted on a Kurdish civil rights activist Facebook page, which shows a Syrian Kurdish child at a rally thanking our Kurdish service for its coverage and for launching its radio on television broadcast, which allows many Syrian Kurds to watch and listen to VOA Kurdish for the first time, thanks to its being available on satellite.
How large is that audience to VOA Kurdish?
I don't have the figures right now. The measured audience in Iran is... in Iraq, actually, where we really did the survey, went up to about 5.3%. I don't know what that translates into numbers, but it was down low. It has risen in the last year. I can get you those numbers afterwards.
Who is competing with you in providing services in Syria? Do you know what other sources of information?
As far as Kurdish language is concerned, there are various different Kurdish radio stations that broadcast, but I don't know of any that are actually getting information from Syria to broadcast to Syria. Most of the Syrian language, the Syrian broadcasters are in Arabic. And
are you saying we're it?
We are basically it as far as being able to get information to the Kurdish population.
And how many reporters do you have on this?
There are approximately 12, including contractors, approximately 12 Kurdish language service people, and we have about 5 stringers in the region.
On the Arabic side, who is providing the information that is also reaching the Arab-speaking parts of the country?
That'd be Al-Hara and Radio Sawa. And we have direct reach in with the direct-to-home satellite TV, and then we have radio transmitters both in Jordan and in Lebanon that broadcast into Syria. Obviously, we can't have FMs in the country, but we do get a fairly good signal into Damascus and a couple of other major cities.
Any sense of your market penetration in Syria?
The last survey that was done 2 or 3 years ago was a telephone survey, which has inherent limitations, but it was actually fairly large. I want to say 20%. Do you remember, Bruce, offhand?
About that, yeah.
We were surprised and pleased. I think another one has been done. We just haven't gotten the results. Is that correct?
There is a new survey in that confirms strong performance by both Al-Hura and Radio Sahel inside of Syria. And we can make that available to mm-hmm. to the board.
I'd love to see a Syrian summary.
Sure.
Our activity and the uptick, too. Mm-hmm.
And the others that are broadcasting in there that are also making up the 80%, what do you think the chief services are that are also reaching Syria in Arabic?
Well, the typical Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, I don't know, Bruce, if you remember what this recent survey that just came out says. There are Syrian stations that actually have fairly high viewership. Whether they're believed or not is another matter, but they are viewed, I think, up as high as 80% of the people in the country watch local Syrian TV every day.
Yeah, Syrian domestic channels are very strong. A range of outside information sources that Brian's just mentioned, and including other non-Arabic channels. The Russians broadcast into Syria. Obviously, of course, our colleague broadcasters, the French, the British, the Germans are broadcasting into Syria, all have Arabic services.
The Iranians. The
Iranians are broadcasting in. It's a very complex, dynamic market. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the local, domestic Syrian channels are still strongly watched. It's very competitive.
And those are government...
Government-controlled.
Yeah. Thank you.
And they capitalize or appeal to the sentiment that Syria is the victim. And there actually is a fair amount of sentiment to believe that the foreign influence, this resonates with some percentage of the population.
Okay. All right. We need to move on to questions. We really need to try to get to the agenda. Governor Ash has a question.
Thank you, Steve.
First of all, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure we're going to get through the significant part of the agenda today. Mr. Reddish, it's my recollection that in January you were asked by David Enzer to go basically take over the PNN management. Are you still doing that, or are you back up on the third floor?
I am still the acting director for the Persian News Network.
Okay. And you, how much longer do you anticipate that going on? Because that's been a network that, at best, has been troubled. I'll put it that way.
Yes, it's been troubled. We received a very positive, along with some constructive criticism, but a positive performance review just last week, where viewership is up to about 22% of Iranians, and our programs were positively received by both audiences and by reviewers. But there still is a long way to go. To answer your question, probably within the next 6 to 8 weeks, we should have a permanent director.
All right. To follow up on that, because obviously it's very sensitive and also quite important that to the degree you can get it right, I don't mean you personally, but the agency can get it right, because as to the full-time PNN, you were there to sort of transition it during some difficult personnel issues. Is that process underway? I mean, the bids are out, I mean, and people are applying for the position. Is that's what's happening? I'm not asking for names or anything, just the process.
The process, as far as internal candidates, is nearly complete. We posted the job for director internally first, because of various different issues regarding the 2013 budget submission. There were four internal candidates who applied. The panel has interviewed all four. There's been a recommendation, and it is now before David Ensor and I, David Ensor and me, to look that over. And when David gets back next week, that will be on his agenda to interview the candidates that were recommended by the panel to go forward.
So,
and then after that, David and I will make a decision as to whether to select a candidate or to advertise it outside.
Okay, that last part answered my question of if you were not fully satisfied with one of the internal candidates. Did you have the right, and would you go externally? I can only wish you the very best, because this agency is extremely, has just been a problem, and I think it predates this board being in place and goes back many, many years for a variety of reasons. The other questions I'm asking you are really asked because you're here representing David Enzer, but VOA questions as opposed to your interim role as a PNN director. But we heard earlier today from Mr. Lobo about the OPM, Office of Personnel Management survey, which he may discuss in some detail when we get to his part of the meeting. But the unfortunate news, and I ask this because most of those surveys go to VOA employees with perhaps some to IBB, but that's predominantly where OPM doesn't survey their grantees, and they don't survey contract employees either. But last year the participation was 67%, which was pretty good. This year it dropped almost a third down to 48%, which is not good. And what, in your view, if you're aware of this, accounts for in 1 year such a drop-off? Is it everyone thinks things are great, or they say, what the heck, it doesn't matter if we answer the survey, nothing's going to change, or somewhere in between? And this just deals with the below 50% participation, and then you throw in a third of VOA or contract employees, and they're not surveyed at all. So really, the survey, if you combine contract and employees and full-time federal employees, comes down to about 35% of the workforce, because you've excluded a third right off the start, and then less than half are answering the ones who were surveyed. What do you see as the reason for this most unfortunate drop-off that Governor Mulhall brought to our attention with the question he asked in the prior meeting?
Well, first of all, OPM makes the rules as far as who gets surveyed, not Voice of America or IBB. So as far as why contractors are not surveyed, I really can't answer that question. That's an OPM question. As far as the participation and response rate is concerned, I will say that last year there were incentives offered for divisions that had the largest or had a certain percentage of response rate over a certain percentage, and there were incentives last year. There were no incentives this year. The 48% response rate this year does represent an increase over the response rate 2 years ago.
What do you mean there were incentives?
The survey came at a time when the 2013 fiscal budget, fiscal year 2013 budget was revealed. There were tremendous cuts to Voice of America in that 2013 budget, and I will just leave it at that.
Well, let me ask, Mr. Radish, you said something that I didn't know about. What do you mean there were incentives last year? We were paying people to respond, or
offering pizza parties. There were pizza parties offered for high response rates for divisions and departments.
Okay, so the absence of a pizza party may have impacted. I won't say voter.
You asked for the various factors, and that was one of the factors that contributed to a very high response rate last year.
Okay. I think that this is going to be addressed in Director Lobo's report as well. So
he wouldn't know about the pizza.
Well, no, he wouldn't. But
he would. Okay.
Well, yes, he would.
Well,
okay.
I have another question.
All right.
Which is, Mr. Radish, are you there?
Yes. Yes.
One thing that I've been told by AFGE, and you may very well disagree with this, and I'm not saying I agree with it or don't agree, but I think it's relevant, and I shared this with my colleagues on the board and Mr. Enzer and others. I'm not sure you were on the email chain, but it was public, is that the labor negotiations, which started in March of 2011, are still ongoing a week a month and are, according to Mrs. Cabral, going to go till December of 2012, if then, and beyond, conceivably, which I find, and this is on a contract that's goes back to 2005. Is there not anything that could be done to speed up the resolution of this? And and sign a contract that's at least in broad terms agreeable to both labor and management?
Unfortunately, I'm not involved in those labor negotiations. The Voice of America is not specifically represented. It's an IBB issue, and I cannot personally respond with any knowledge of where the negotiations stand or what is impeding the negotiations.
I suggest we deal with this in Director Lobo's report. I think that Governor Meehan I'm going to violate my own rule. Governor Meehan has a motion he wants to offer, I believe, on the subject that you raised with regard to Voice of America and RFA.
Thanks. Congratulations to VOA on the news that the Burmese government's open to having a Voice of America English teaching session. This is a matter that I've had great interest in, and I know Governor McHugh and Governor Ash and the whole board has been interested in Burma and the new opportunities there, the excitement of opening up and relaxing some of the press media restrictions that they've had. Very excited to watch the parliamentary elections in early April and the results there. Our RFA and VOA are excited to have Aung San Suu Kyi as a guest commentator, a frequent appearer on their programs. For 2 years ago this month, most of us on this board were confirmed by the U.S. Senate, and we've been working, trying to find the opportunities where we can move forward together, leveraging the great assets of all the U.S. international broadcasting networks. And so I would like to move that the board notes that this opportunity to establish a credible presence for all of U.S. international broadcasting in Burma and the important role that both of the properties, Voice of America and Radio Free Asia, play in that market. The board directs the Voice of America director and the Radio Free Asia president as a condition of the BBG grant to RFA for Burmese program to work with the IBB director to coordinate the activities in and for Burma, including in-country bureaus, sharing of stringer networks, where appropriate, sharing content. I'm also very interested in my role on the Budget and Strategy Committee about a pilot project on the satellite television program that we've discussed. I hope the director can work with both of those networks to bring to the board in the July meeting a recommendation of how to proceed to leverage that. And I ask that the Department of State and the appropriate congressional oversight committees be keep appraised of the VOA and RFA activities in Burma. I move that the board adopts my resolution.
Is there a second? There is any discussion?
Yes. Mr. Meehan, should not the last sentence be modified to be a little stronger and that appropriate congressional approval for, it's not activities, but an office in Burma be sought? I mean, that's what it's all about. It doesn't say that.
I think what's required is notification, not a congressional approval.
Well, then say...
That's correct.
Then that it should be notified. I guess I'm a stickler for using the precise language, but it should say should be notified of VOA and RFA. Is it offices or is the difference between activities and an office? We have activities right now.
Yes, and we have we do have activities in and around Burma from both of the properties, and the Congress is aware of that as they fund that. But I think what we want to make sure is that if there's new programming, which we're looking for, particularly the satellite pilot, or whether it makes sense to have a physical office there or not. I'd like the staff to come back to us with that recommendation.
I would say it should be notified of if VOA and or RFA are determined to establish an office in Burma.
Well, I would suggest respectfully that I think that Congress should be notified if the board decides to put offices
there. Exactly. If the board, let's phrase it that way.
So let's do that.
So you accept that as a friendly amendment? All right. Yes. Accept that as a friendly amendment. Is there any further discussion?
I want it read back. Make sure you have it.
Governor, could you repeat? Because I missed it. There's a lot of back and forth. The Department of State and appropriate congressional oversight committees be notified. We currently have a VOA and RFA activities in Burma.
Correct me if I'm wrong. If the BBG board determines that an office for VOA and or RFA should be established in Burma, is that consistent with what? Do you get that, Paul?
Okay. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor of the motion say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is agreed to. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Steve, for the VOA report. Now turning to... the RFERL report, Steve Korn.
Thank you. On May 17th last month, we at RFERL lost a member of our family. I am. Yeah. No, these mics need to be turned off. Okay. I said that on May 17th, we at RFERL lost a member of our family. Our colleague and reporter in Radio Mashal, Hasiba Shahid was unfortunately taken from us in an auto accident here in Prague. She was an award-winning journalist, a role model to other Afghan women. She was a mother of two young children and a wife, and she was merely 29 years old. Yesterday, we decided that we would start and fund the Hasiba Shahid Journalism Fellowship Program, wherein we would select every 6 months a Afghan woman journalist to work with us in Kabul, and then at the very end of that six-month period here in Prague for a short time. This is our way, or one of the ways, in which we want to remember her and honor her memory and extend her legacy. And we hope that many more young Afghan women are able to follow in her exemplary footsteps. I have a presentation here that has a short note about Hasiba, and then you will see the last story that she ever did.
Never did I imagine I would be talking about Hasiba after she's gone. I cannot imagine her death. In fact, no one can. She was so full of life. Her absence has created an emptiness everywhere, and I know workplace is not going to be the same without her. When she was fighting for life, I kept praying she would come back so that I could hug her and tell her that I love her so much. I've known Hasiba for more than 2 years, and all I know is that her life exemplified brilliance and hard work that needs to be lauded. She was brave and always had a smile on her face. She didn't believe in giving up. She was a visionary who was creative, innovative, and thoughtful. She was an embodiment of how good a person can be, a good friend, a good wife, a good colleague, and a mentor. She gave energy, commitment, and inspiration to all of us. She was a person of splendid character with a big heart. She would always advise me on things both in my office and personal life. In this time of bereavement, we pray that this moment of burden gets easy on us. May Allah Almighty give us and her family the courage, strength, and patience to bear this loss. Dear Hasiba, you will truly be missed. We will always miss your beautiful face and wonderful smile. There's too much to say about our dearest friend Hasiba, but to be brief, I would like to conclude my tribute with the following lines from Robert Frost's poem. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep.
په افغانستان او پاکستان کې د ترهګرۍ ضد جګړه کې درته د هغو څلورو میندو انځور.
We are going to present the story of four mothers who lost their sons in the anti-terror war in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Of those four mothers, the first story is about the one who lost her son. This is about Amma Gula, a mother coming from Loyawela of the rest of Kandahar province of Afghanistan. 45 years old Amma Gula, sons fell victim to the anti-terror war.
This is a really hard time and needs lots of courage. I need to take care of both, his widow and children. So we are much worried about their future. It's okay so far, I'm alive. But what will become of them when I'm no more?
Just like Amma Gula, another mother across the border in Pakistan lost her son fighting the militants in the tribal areas. The young man was working with the Pakistani Frontier Constabulary.
He was my son. This is his wife. He had 5 kids. He was innocent. This is a tragedy for us. We were unable to do anything. It was God's will. We didn't know what exactly happened. Later, we were told that they have been killed.
The agony of those mothers was exactly the same as that of the one whose sons
according to them, were killed by Taliban. One of those mothers, who is not ready to accept her son was involved in any mischief, talked, and she says,
"My son was a respectable person. He was a religious man. He has never been involved in such activities. They picked him, and we came to know about his death. It was a hard time. May God save everyone from such trouble."
You listen to the views of those mothers whose sons got killed in fighting, and they were complaining for not getting assistance from the government. But there's another mother who lost her son, but she doesn't ask the government for help. Becky Whetstone is an American mother whose son went to Afghanistan in 2011 as a soldier to fight the anti-terror war and later died there. She says,
"I personally have never understood why war is necessary. Now, my son had to learn this on his own through his own experience. To me, the only thing that matters now is to end this type of madness and find other ways to resolve issues. I really believe that peace is the only way."
The rest of my report is contained in my written report, which I submitted to you last week.
Questions for Steve Korn? Any questions for Steve Korn?
Yes, I was going to ask Mr. Korn. It's my understanding that Mr. James Jeffrey resigned from RFE, and did he deal with congressional relations?
He was involved in outreach, yes. He was involved in
outreach. And I didn't know if there are any plans, or you're just going to eliminate the position, or...
We have no intention of fulfilling it until we know where we stand with consolidation. It would seem to me to be irresponsible at this point to fill a position that might be taken up in consolidation. Once the board makes this decision, we'll reevaluate our position.
Well, I'm not suggesting you should or shouldn't. I do suggest that when a position like that becomes vacant, it would have been helpful if the board had been notified and not just learned it, because it's a significant position, just like Susan Andrews leaving. That's my personal opinion. And we were not notified.
Any other questions?
Consolidation is, this is Tara Sonnenschein in Washington. Is consolidation a factor now in people making short-term decisions, in which case, what is the timetable so that employment decisions are not held up by conversations? Because I think that would mean that the board needs to deal with this issue in a timely way, if indeed it's a factor in programming throughout the organization or employment.
Thank you. I couldn't have said it better myself. Yes, it is a factor. We are waiting for the board to decide because we are holding certain positions open which wouldn't make sense or might not make sense in the event of consolidation. Nor would it be easy to recruit somebody into a position if they know that it might be eliminated in the short term. So I would urge the board to make a decision as soon as possible.
Those are good points. I might suggest then by the July meeting, we'd be prepared to vote on it.
I think that would be the hope, that we might be in a position to debate and just make a final determination in July. But we'll see. But the points are well taken, that there are issues that they impact the networks, the ongoing activities of the networks. So,
and if I could just add, particularly as it relates to the external affairs post, I know that VOA recently has an opening, and I appreciate Steve Korn's approach. But, you know, for 2 years ago when we first got to the board, one of the chronic complaints were each company went to the Capitol Hill with a different agenda. And then Governor Perino and I, and along with Governor McHugh, spent a significant amount of time trying to construct this. So it would be U.S. International Broadcasting was represented on Capitol Hill and not five separate congressional relations, five separate communications. And so while I appreciate the service of the various people who have had their time here, I do, whether consolidation moves forward or not, on this particular matter, this is certainly a place where we could all pull together, regardless of how the board votes, to all row in the same direction. So I look forward to Lynn and working through and that we've got the right staff and the right people to do the job we need to do. So.
May I make a comment about that? I wholeheartedly agree. Lynn and I have talked, the one trip I made to Capitol Hill, Lynn accompanied me on. I personally agree that there ought to be one person doing external and congressional outreach on behalf of all of USIB. That was my opinion before Lynn was on. Her predecessor didn't quite see it the same way. I completely agree with you, Mike.
Any other questions for in RFP report? Okay. Thank you, Steve. Libby Liu, Radio Free Asia.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for that tribute. It was a tragic loss. She was obviously a great talent and had great courage. So thank you for sharing that with us and accept our sympathies.
Thanks, Liz.
It's terrible. The substance of RFA's work and accomplishments, particularly with regard to content, are contained in my written board report. The visual that I brought to share with you today is focused on the video programming, just to show you some of the new ways that we're reaching our audience. You'll see a clip taken by a Phnom Penh cameraman about Cambodian street children who work 10 hours a day for $2, and they are just a big source of human trafficking victims. Then we'll show you a one-minute clip from our human trafficking report about a Cambodian who was sold into Thai fishery labor, and then we'll show you our first ebook published. It's a cameraman's journal during his assignment in Burma, Cambodia, China, and Korea. As you know, and thank you to Radio Free Europe for hosting on May 24th a preview of our TV documentary, The Invisible World, on the topic of modern human slavery. And VOA, thank you, because you will be broadcasting that on your satellite everywhere, and we very much appreciate the cooperation. And finally, I want to highlight that if you want to, you can go to the iTunes store and download the ebook, because we've made it downloadable for mobile device reading. So let me show you video reporting.
ពីទឹកខ្វះជីវភាពអត់លុយអត់កាក់ចឹងបាននឹងដើរវាយស្រាចលុយចឹមបងប្អូនក្នុងមួយថ្ងៃពីរមួយចឹងឲ្យមកមើលមិនប៉ើមើលបីទឹកបីពាន់នេះចាមិនដឹងធ្វើស្អីហងរងឯងខ្ញុំនៅរៀនកំបានរៀន
This is the remarkable account of a man who's been to hell and back. Since his return, he has recreated his experiences in a series of drawings. He believes without these pictures, no one would believe his story.
This hub page features the video reports from Burma, Korea, China, and Cambodia, as well as individual stories and general route maps of the trek undertaken by refugees and our reporters alike. Additionally, for a behind-the-scenes look at what it took to cover this story, we include the lead cameraman's journal. The assignment was life-changing for him, and his observations are part of the story. The whole series, including the ebook, is now available for download and streaming in our iTunes store.
Thank you.
Questions for thank you, Libby. Any questions for RFA?
No, I have a question for Libby. I thought that was that's extraordinary. Thank you for that powerful reporting. On distribution, are you in touch with any of the trafficking NGOs that I think would probably be interested in distributing it even further?
Yes, and several NGOs were in attendance at the May 24th event, and there have been press stories about the event and the documentary series.
That's great. Since Burma was mentioned in the piece, how many RFA people are in Burma reporting on stories like that?
Well, that was a particular documentary feature that we do once a year. But in Burma, at any given time, we can have 5-6 stringers doing reporting from all over the country. Right now, two of our, the head of the Burmese service and her boss, the head of the Southeast Asian service, are out there to try to strategize about how we really want to approach Burma. When I was there, I had extensive conversations with the Minister of Information, which we could probably talk about in an RFA board meeting, but it gave us some guidance.
Thank you.
Other questions for Governor Ash?
Ms. Liu, Victor Ash speaking. I wanted to ask, does RFA as a corporate entity, do you all have requirements or regulations which if you or an employee of RFA belong to a for-profit or not-for-profit board would have to disclose that under the ethics or code of ethics? And if they attended meetings during RFA time, would they have to take annual leave? What's your policy on that?
We do have a policy about all outside activities, and they go into a conflict form, which is reviewed by several managers all the way up the chain, depending on whether they're on the programming side or the operational side. Generally speaking, they take time off when they work on their alternate activity.
Is there any exception? I mean, time off would be during a normal working day. You wouldn't have to take time off if it were Saturday or Sunday, would you?
No, of course not.
All right, but if during a working day you were on the board of United Way and went to a three-hour board meeting or maybe you had a conference call that you participated in at the office, would that necessitate that person would take annual leave off? So even as meritorious as United Way is, it still is not RFA business.
Generally, that is true, except under the Department of Labor laws, we don't necessarily go hour by hour for leave. So it's a complicated issue. But in general, if you take a significant portion of a day, you can take a half day of vacation to attend a meeting. If it's an hour, then you probably would just work an extra hour.
All right. But is there a threshold at which, under your procedures, it becomes, quote, a significant part of the day? Would that be in excess of 2 hours, in excess of three? Certainly would be if it were 5 or 6 hours. When does the threshold kick in?
It's generally about a half day. You know, so
half
it's day. Like three to 4 hours. We would consider that a half All day, right. And you would probably take a half day off.
If one belonged to a for-profit corporate board, he or she, while it's permissible, would certainly, would they have to take time off?
Yes, of course, but that's, of course, predicated on whether or not the conflicts committee has cleared that event, you know, that activity.
Well, assuming there's no conflict and you belong to such a board, would you have to take annual leave if you, you know, spent Wednesday attending such a meeting?
Yes.
Is that a yes or a no?
Oh, it's yes. I'm sorry. I'm far away from the microphone.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else for Libby Lou? Okay, thank you very much. Middle East Broadcasting Network's Brian Conniff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just mention a few highlights on events that have happened over the last month relating to the dynamic situation in the Middle East. Egypt has been front and center. We've treated Egypt as a local story and as a pan-Arab story. The Middle East is watching everything that's happening there to see whether they can successfully take the transition to democracy. And also the Mubarak trial has been watched closely as an indication of whether accountability can actually be achieved. To accomplish our coverage of these events, we entered into a co-production partnership with a popular Egyptian channel, Al Hayat. As part of that process, we conducted a series of high-profile interviews with the presidential candidates. This was in the first round, and it was attended by other members of Egyptian political life questioning the candidates, something that hadn't been done before. Obviously, they hadn't had real presidential elections. And it afforded us the opportunity to enter into the homes of millions of Egyptians that we had never been able to enter before. We had a commentator as well as our logo prominently displayed on the set. So we were quite happy about that. We have a continuing arrangement with the station to do the two finalists for the presidential election now scheduled for June 16th and 17th. For the coverage of the actual election, we also approached it as a local as well as a pan-Arab channel. We had correspondents, both Al-Hara and Sawa, correspondents in large cities throughout Egypt and in small towns, polling booths, taxi drivers, men on the street type interviews. So we provided coverage for the actual election day itself as if we were a local channel. But in addition, in the days leading up to the event as well as the days afterwards, we provided expert analysis on talk shows similar to Free Hour and Hiwar Cairo. And also Radio Sawa expanded its news coverage from its shorter 5-minute news breaks to 30-minute news breaks for the day of the actual election and the day after. So that continues to be a major part of our coverage, and obviously we'll do a similar comprehensive coverage during the finalists scheduled for mid-June. Also, in early May, we broadcast the fourth episode of the five-part series on the Arab Spring that we're in partnership with the McNeil Lear Production House. This episode was on Syria, which was a much more challenging episode to produce, but we think added value to the environment. And then in closing, in May, we finally launched the new and improved websites for both Al-Hara and Radio Sawa. These websites are supported by Pangea, and we think it will provide a user-friendly or a journalist-friendly, I should say, way of providing news and information, updating the website, and also providing for interaction, which is obviously the direction we want to go. We want to take the website beyond just being a passive venue to something being interactive with our audience, and this is something that Pangea will be helpful in. So, Mr. Chairman, that's my report. Any questions?
Did you have a video or anything? Or your,
no.
Tara, Undersecretary Sonnenschein.
You mentioned twice the difference between a local story and a pan-Arab story. And from my own reference, do all the entities distinguish between local, regional, global coverage, both in terms of resource capability decisions and purpose or objective, or is every entity capable of and desirous of doing local coverage and the wider angle, or do we separate those out?
I let my colleagues speak for themselves, but part of our, it's the judgment calls we have to make every day, and that is if you go too local into a Lebanese political story, you're going to discourage the rest of the region from watching it. So you have to make calls about what is local but also has pan-Arab, in our case, interest. And those are tough calls. We don't want to be perceived as a local channel in any one of these specific marketplaces. There are a lot of local channels in all these countries. We don't want to really compete with them. So we're always trying to find this balance of a story that is in a particular country, but also has appeal. It has themes that appeal across the region. That's the judgment call we go through every day in making those decisions.
And the same viewer may want both.
Yes, exactly. And they usually do watch both. As somebody in America would watch their local news at 6 o'clock, they're going to watch the network at 7. We assume that that's the judgment that most viewers will go through. So we're looking at the network angle, but with those kinds of stories that somebody would be interested in Morocco about what's going on in Egypt.
Understood.
And we're pretty much the opposite. We do want to be perceived as a local station for the market that we're going towards. To the extent that we do coverage of regional or international activities, it's like a segue into how that impacts you in Cambodia. So it's very different because he has one language that has multiple markets, and we have one language for one market. So thank you.
Any questions?
This is Carlos.
Wait a minute. Governor McHugh first, please.
I'm sorry.
Quick question. Brian, thank you for your report. On the new websites,
yes.
I'm curious about what kind of interactivity you're engaging in or that you anticipate.
Well, right now it's questions, polls, particularly with the all events going in Egypt, the basic questions, which candidate do you like? What do you think will happen if the Islamists win? I mean, that's sort of standard interaction. We do see eventually putting blogs up. In fact, this week we're having training with our journalists about how to do blogs, because there's a lot of journalistic ethics questions that come up. It's still what you would normally expect. It doesn't have anything much beyond that. We're working with Rob Bowles, though, with some of our programs about sort of behind the scenes, you know, the green room discussions before and after. We've done some of that, but it's sort of pilot projects right now.
Maybe in July or in the fall we can get a report on how it's working.
Okay, that'd be good. Look forward to that.
Carlos, you had a question?
No, I was just want to answer the Undersecretary's question. We're pretty much like Libby's. We try to be local, then we bounce off the news to try to get content from the Americas, the United States, Latin America, and the rest of the world. But that, I just want to clarify that to answer her question.
Thank you. Any other questions? Governor Ash.
Mr. Karloff?
Yes.
I was going to ask you a similar question to what I asked Mrs. Liu at MBN. If you or any employee of MBN belong to a for-profit corporate board or a non-profit 501c3 board, one, is that permitted? And would it have to be, two, disclosed to MBN?
We have a very similar policy. In fact, I think all of the grantees' conflict of interest policies were written or coordinated, so they probably all read about the same. If an employee has any outside interest, be it nonprofit or profit, they're required to disclose that. And it's what you would normally expect. In addition, our time and attendance system requires an employee, if they're absent from work, to report it either as, in a variety of different categories, but they're required to account for their day.
So if they were taking time off to do something that wasn't MBN related, they would be required to take some form of leave.
And that would be true if it was conducted from the office for a certain amount of time? That is, you participate on, say, a conference call from the office and obviously weren't doing MBN work,
I mean, the
you
report,
were spend a couple hours.
The policy doesn't get that specific, but I would probably say that what Libby said would be acceptable, and that is if you spent an hour on that and you wanted to work another hour later that night, that would all be fine. It's, you know, we're not accounting for it that precisely. But, in general, the idea is to indicate what you did during that work day.
Okay, any other questions for Brian Conniff at MBN? Thank you very much, Brian.
Just one from here. I think both Governor McHugh and I are wondering if the line of questioning is something that the whole Board of Governors should know what is leading to the question so that we're not...
Perhaps Governor Ash might have answered the question.
Yes, Susan.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I was just wondering, Governor Ash, if there's something in particular that's occurring that we need to be aware of.
Well, when I secure all the information I need to secure, I will certainly share it with you. But yes, I mean, there's a reason I'm not just doing it to take up time. There have been comments made to me that I think bear further exploration, and asking the questions is one way of me finding out if the comments have validity to them.
Well, I would also say that we've announced that the Governance Committee will take up the issue of these issues of involvement on nonprofit boards and reporting of the time associated with that and other external activities, and I believe that's the appropriate approach for that. So. Thank you.
The reason I did it now is since the next Governance Committee meeting is an unknown date and maybe at least 6 to 7 weeks from now, I think I wanted to secure at least some preliminary answers before then and not wait that long.
Michael Linton, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Okay, fine. We're going to move now into some business items, and the first item on this business item relates to a proposed protocol for the protection of confidential information. And by way of background, I would like to make the following statement. At the request of several governors, I would like to introduce a resolution to establish some ground rules and policy among the governors regarding disclosure of non-public and pre-decisional information. These ground rules are important to protect the integrity of the board's deliberative process. The Broadcasting Board of Governors operates under a number of important legal constraints that require the board to establish a significant level of transparency and public access to board proceedings, including the Government and the Sunshine Act and the Freedom of Information Act. The current board has opened its proceedings in a far greater manner than any previous board. We hold open meetings. The agency's FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, compliance has substantially improved over the last few years. More documents are posted on the BBG website for public review than at any time in the past. To be clear, in establishing or proposing to establish ground rules among governors regarding disclosure of public and pre-decisional information, no other governor intends to retreat to a position of public inaccessibility or to reverse the steps we have taken as a board. In other words, we intend to be as open, as transparent as law and prudent policy allow. The fact is, however, that the agency, the board, and each individual governor have legitimate institutional interests allowing agency management, outside advisors, and individual governors to brief the board and have the board consider and discuss information without fear that information will be leaked without the board's knowledge or authorization. The need to protect the integrity of the deliberative process in which the leadership of an executive branch agency engages in discharging constitutional and statutory duties is well recognized in law and practice. The United States Supreme Court has recognized, quote, the valid need for protection of communications between government officials and those who advise and assist them in the performance of their manifold duties, and further stated, quote, the importance of this confidentiality is too plain to require further discussion. Human experience teaches that those who expect public dissemination of the remarks may well temper candor with a concern for appearances and for their own interests to the detriment of the decision-making process. Further, in a separate opinion, the Supreme Court also recognized that disclosing, quote, the communications and the ingredients of the decision-making process, unquote, might inevitably, quote, injure the quality of agency decisions by inhibiting frank discussion of legal or policy matters, unquote. President Obama has directed all federal agencies, including the BBG, to increase transparency. But even the administration's open government directive makes provision for protection of confidentiality. According to the administration's 2009 open government directive, quote, nothing in this directive shall be construed to suggest that the presumption of openness precludes the legitimate protection of information whose release would threaten national security, invade personal privacy, breach confidentiality, or damage other genuinely compelling interests, unquote. Recently, the Office of the Inspector General of the National Labor Relations Board found that the unauthorized disclosure of non-public information constitutes a violation of federal ethics laws. The ground rules that we are proposing that the board should adopt are set forth in the one-page resolution which has been distributed to the board. The resolution defines deliberative information that should not be disclosed without the board's authorization. This simple policy, by its terms, will be interpreted in a manner consistent with the board's obligations under the government and the Sunshine Act. The ground rules proposed in the resolution are based on best federal practices in light of the experience of other agencies that are also subject to the government and the Sunshine Act. So with that, I'd invite questions or comments on the proposed policy.
Well, isn't the attorney who drafted it not going to explain what's in it?
Well, I think if you want to ask questions.
We've only had it for 10 hours.
You have a question?
Would you explain what's in it? I would think the board, you would want to know that. You can't tell me what's in it. You couldn't tell me 2 hours ago.
Well, I'm comfortable with the policy as it's written.
But you're comfortable with something you can't explain, which is good.
Well, I don't.
I admire your comfort level.
Well, that's fine.
Thank you very much, Governors. Well, what this policy would be doing for those governors, this is the attachment one to the draft record of decisions. But what it basically
does. Can you speak
does
into the mic?
Yes, I'm sorry. What it basically does is define a category of information called deliberative, which is a defined term, deliberative information, which means non-public information that's exchanged between two or more governors or between agency staff members and of governors. Which is pre-decisional and deliberative, meaning that it's the subject of the board's consideration prior to the announcement of a final board decision. The definition of deliberative information specifically excludes factual information that is otherwise publicly available, and it excludes individual governors' own opinions that do not reflect the board's deliberative process. Those are not part of deliberative information. Yes, it does. In the definition of deliberative information, which is in the second full paragraph of the definition. Now, with respect to this category of information, of deliberative information, the policy would establish that each member of the board is obligated not to disclose certain aspects of that information, the substance of deliberative information or the status of discussions about it, the positions of other governors regarding the deliberative information or their individual comments about it, documents prepared to provide the board with deliberative information or to memorialize any aspect of the deliberative information or any subsection or part of those documents, as well as the identity of governors or staff members who provide deliberative information or prepare deliberative information for the board. The policy goes on to say that the obligation not to disclose that kind of information continues after the decision is publicly announced, and that such information will remain protected until the board authorizes the release of the information. It recommends that the deliberative information should be released after consultation with the agency's Office of General Counsel regarding the implications of waiving the deliberative process privilege, and upon an official board resolution providing authority to do so. And finally, the policy notes that disclosure of deliberative information is a serious matter and constitutes mismanagement and misconduct. It also notes, as as was noted in the recent National Labor Relations Board decision, Office of Inspector General decision that Governor Mulhoff spoke to, that unauthorized disclosure of official non-public information is prohibited by federal ethics rules. And finally, this policy by its terms makes clear that the policy does not affect the agency's requirements to comply with the Government of the Sunshine Act and will be implemented in a manner consistent with the provisions of the Government of the Sunshine Act.
All right. Mr. Comer, just so I can understand, it's very clear that by this protocol you're saying that the full board would need to vote to, in effect, declassify or open up particular documents. Is that correct?
If it were deliberative information, right, then the board would have to waive the embargo, basically.
Right. Or, so that's to release it.
Yes.
My question is, does the full board or a member of the board need to approve it being labeled deliberative or pre-decisional, to use your word? Or is that something a staff member does, but only the board? The board has no role in determining what is pre-decisional or
well
done. I don't see that in here. You take care of the last part, but you don't seem to take care of the front end part.
Well that's thanks, Governor Ash. Actually, that's the purpose of this memo. The purpose of this policy is to define a category of information which, by its terms, it becomes subject to this non-disclosure obligation. The board is now making, if it adopts this policy, is making the decision that this category of information becomes protected. So that's what you would be doing if you were to vote for it.
At the risk of having a running debate, and I'm not going to engage in a running debate, I'll make a statement at the end. What you're saying is a little bit like beauty. It's in the eyes of the holder. And your definition may be clear to you. It may not be clear to the person sitting next to you or to someone else. And people have major debates, and that's why you have lawsuits as to what is what. And, I noticed that, for example, you know, we have people going to the Hill advocating a CEO position and certain what it should contain. It's labeled pre-decisional. But if a governor goes, he's in violation of confidential rule or releases it. I don't understand that.
Okay.
Just
a point of clarification. Yeah. If I've understood this right, is that this policy that's being proposed would allow a classification. And if you think beauty is X and I think it's Y, it allows for the board to have a vote to say whether X or Y carries the day. If I've understood
if
this
that's
right.
What, if that's what it is, correctly. I agree with you, but that's not what it says. If it was specific that they would have to decide on that prior to it going out and everyone had a vote in it, I commend you. But what I have a problem is just as you became upset, rightly so, about Mr. Enger announcing an office in Burma without board's approval, according to this, someone's going to, on staff, I assume, or my good friend, the esteemed Mr. Lobo, who is not a member of the board, but a valued consultant and friend, will label this pre-decisional or confidential or not for distribution, and no member of the board voted on it or had anything to do with it. But to get it to be open and no longer pre-decisional, the board has to meet to declassify it. I mean, that seems to be where we're headed, but if I'm wrong, I'd like to be wrong.
Okay, if you were to say Freedom of Information Act and their precedents, or language in the laws that protect classified information, or language in the laws and regulations that protect proprietary non-public commercial information, you would find exactly the same types of categories, exactly the same types of definitional categories that you have here. In other words, to a certain extent, yes, you have to decide that information fits within a particular category. But I don't think if we read this, I don't think that is really that difficult.
But on a case,
it's non-public information, either a tangible record or otherwise, exchanged between two or more governors or between agency staff members and the governors. It's pre-decisional, and it's deliberative, meaning that it's the subject of the board's consideration prior to the announcement of a final board decision. That's not a particularly opaque or difficult to understand. At least, you know, it might guidance be required in particular cases? Probably. Not different from FOIA, not different from laws on classification, not different from laws regarding the protection of commercial, non-public proprietary information.
First of all, I'm the only member of this board who's an attorney, has a law license. Secondly, attorneys differ. That's why they get on different sides of the lawsuit. And they, reasonable people can arrive at different conclusions. And certainly on this issue we have. I'm well aware, and I'm that this will pass and it'll be adopted. But I think it's important here in a public meeting that whoever's listening should know this, at least I, as one member of the board, did not have a copy of this final document until you emailed it to me last night. There has been no committee consideration. And the question I'm asking, you haven't provided the Freedom of Information Act and the documents where we could read it together and decide whether I agree with your verbal explanation of it or don't. And any lawyer worth his law degree will look at the written document as well as the verbal explanation of the document. And no committee of this board has done that. The board has just apparently determined you're going to pass it and be done with it, and hopefully that'll put it to bed. If life were only that simple, that would be fine. Life's not that simple. And, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your remarks today. And I'm sure you're sincere in hoping that this will resolve this matter. I think that this represents a giant step backwards. And let me just say where I'm coming from and why I feel the way I feel. In fact, I had a conversation with Mrs. Weil a few weeks ago when I think she was sort of shocked, not because she disagreed, but just was shocked of the environment in which I grew up as an adult in the state of Tennessee. I authored Tennessee, along with others, in a bipartisan way, Tennessee's Open Records Act. I authored Tennessee's Open Meetings Act, which are different. The Open Records Act in many states is far stronger than the Federal Freedom of Information Act ever dreamed of being. Now, certainly in the federal level, when it's national security issues and military issues, there are obvious reasons for exemptions. I don't think that applies here, except perhaps in a few isolated cases. But when I was mayor of Knoxville, and it happened, if someone wanted to walk into my office and ask to review the top shelf on the top drawer in the file cabinet, as long as we had somebody there with them, make sure they didn't take it, they were entitled to see it. No questions asked. This word pre-decisional didn't exist. Two members of my city council could not meet without people being there. The search committee for the new press in the University of Tennessee, which has gone on for 5 or 6 years, has had to meet in public because that's what the open record...
Is that why it's gone on for 5 or 6 years?
Is that one?
I was asking if that's why the search has gone on for 5 or 6 years.
Well, actually, it hadn't gone on for 5 or 6 years. There have been different searches, and but like many universities, some work out and some don't. I don't think it can be...
I was kidding.
I'm sure you were. And this is a serious issue. I simply say that because I'm used to operating in that environment, and it doesn't upset me. And I think a lot of this effort here today is more of convenience than it is of necessity.
I know you're not, and we'll have a chance for you to come back, but I think I've had a couple of people email me to say that they'd like to speak too. So, I mean, I'm happy to recognize you some more.
Do you want me to speak after, as long as I don't relinquish my right to speak?
No, of course you will, but I think, would it be okay if we heard from some other people?
You mean other governors?
Other governors.
Sure. I'd be happy to, but I haven't, you know. Whichever governors want to speak, and I'll yield to them.
Who would like to start?
Maybe no one does.
Well, no. Michael Linton, I know you want to say something.
Yeah, I'm happy to speak. I mean, Victor, I hear everything you're saying, and I don't disagree with what you're describing. I think, though, that we've had a history on the board of some serious problems with leaks, to the press, which suggests not an issue of openness, but rather an active outreach to the press, which is not necessarily condoned by the rest of the board. And I think this resolution does, for more than anything else, makes an effort to stop that. I think in general it makes most of the governors uncomfortable that that there is an active outreach to the press about certain discussions which, you know, may or may not be on the public record. And so I don't think we're trying to close anything down. I think we're just trying to prevent that from happening. And I know that other organizations inside the government have similar confidentiality agreements, and I don't see any reason why we shouldn't.
Thank you, Michael. I was speaking for myself. I remember a meeting that we had, maybe last meeting, where, and Undersecretary Sonnenschein can speak for herself, but she said that the State Department was very reluctant to share information with us given the situation that we find ourselves in, that the information gets leaked. Tara, am I characterizing what you said appropriately?
I was reflecting the sort of self-censorship mode that we need to go in if you're bringing foreign policy material to the board in a private session. There's a reason why you would say it privately but not publicly if it's a classification. Every day we face classification issues on what we should share, but I consider the private board deliberations as a safe place, to talk about information with my colleagues that I might not be as specific about in a public session. So that is a sensitivity, but if people feel it's going to be all public, then you would restrict what you feel comfortable talking about in terms of foreign policy issues that factor into some of the decision making. So I was reflecting some of the reluctance or chilling effect that you have if you're nervous that you're going to say something that is then for everybody to comment on a blog the next day. That is a very difficult position, I think, for any representative from state.
Michael? Amian?
You want to comment on that?
I don't know that you'll want me to do a running debate and comment on every single one. I'll wrap it up towards the end. I'm not trying to belong, but I think there are a number of things I want to say.
Sure. So I'll just speak for myself. I feel that, I've worked in Washington for 27 years, and there's a long time. There's a lot of things that happen inside of government that should be transparent, and I will back a transparent effort. And what my experience on this board has had moments where I can't believe the inaccurate things that have been ascribed to what I've said. So there's nobody more concerned about what you're asked, what your positions are. I don't mind taking criticism for my positions when someone disagrees with me, but I sure do mind when I have my positions mischaracterized as some sort of credible source. So I share everyone's frustration. I think this is a weird, unique thing, this board. We're special government employees, whatever that means. If somebody in my company or somebody in any office that I worked in when I was in government was found to do any of this, you could fire them. You can't get fired from this board, so we have to have this self-policing mechanism, as far as I can tell. We've tried to find a way to deal with this. But what I find is it's a reasonable approach, because if there's a pre-decisional document, and if the default position is pre-decisional document, which is clearly outlined by the administration of what it takes to do that, this board could vote to overturn the decision of a staffer who put it in pre-decisional, and then we could put it in the light of day up in an open meeting. So there's a vehicle to deal with these things that you refer to from your past work on making things more open and transparent, as a way to do that. And then that'll give us all a chance to talk about whether we think it's appropriate to move some of these things along. But for me, what I'm frustrated by is, in every other government place that I've worked in, you can be fired for what happens here. You can be found out to do this, and you can be fired. As a member of the board, you can't be fired. You can only be asked by the president to leave. And so this is an attempt to strike a balance for transparency, but also to be in a place where you can speak your mind. We don't have a lot of time here. We all have private sector lives, and this is just happens to be a thing that we do as part of our extended public service. I don't, we've had to cancel committee meetings because nobody wants to read about mischaracterizations of their opinions. That's not a fun place to work, and I think if you talk to a couple of our former board members in their heart of hearts, they'll talk about that that's one of the reasons why they're not here anymore, is because it's a frustrating place to actually have your point of opinion that is clearly in a space that should be held private. This is a news agency. This is a news organization. Everybody here believes in putting the news out front. But you can't have an honest conversation that I might ultimately vote the other way if my first statement is going to be voted the opposite side. So we accept as part of, you know, no one makes you stay as a governor. No one makes you stay working for the government. But the government has rules that you can't put national security stuff on the front page of the VOA website. There's a law against that. And there should be. There should be certain things that fall into this category. And all we're saying is there are some documents, pre-decisional, that should fall into this category. And there are some documents that should be open. And ultimately later, some of these documents that were used to make the decision do become public. We do get to read about stuff that happens.
Should I jump in?
Yeah,
yes, go ahead. Governor McKeon.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael. Governor McKeon, that was well put. I think as an agency, we have and we need to strive for transparency, which is what we've done. We are about the free flow of information. But at the same time, to Governor Meehan's point, what we need to avoid is the misrepresentation of information. And that happens when partial information may or may not be intentionally leaked to perhaps impact an outcome. And, you know, we need, as a board, to have the free flow of information amongst us. So perhaps through this policy, we'll get there. But I would see this in keeping with our goal of ensuring that what we put out is the most accurate information available to our audiences and to those who share our mission.
Yeah, I mean, the attempt is to have a reasonable balance. And I also would say that if we find that this is not, if it's being too onerous or it's struck the balance in the wrong way, I am more than happy to have it come back to the governance committee or to the full board to be readjusted. That's entirely fine. But this, I think, we're hearing that this was a pretty strong opinion from a large majority of the board about things that are misrepresenting or that are personal attacks or whatever. That's where we're coming from. So the statement I made was on behalf of at least most of the colleagues that have spoken today and others that are not here. And it's not meant to be draconian. It's in line with best practice in federal. It's in other federal agencies. It's consistent with what's being done in federal agencies. And if we find it's gone too far, I'll be the first one, along with most everyone else, to try to adjust it. To make sure that we are, in fact, open. So over to you, Governor Ash.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, thank you for those comments. It was mentioned one person served on the Hill 27 years. I served in elected public office for 31 years, 6 as a state representative, 9 as a state senator, and 16 years as mayor of the city of Knoxville. And I lived under Tennessee's open records law all but 2 of those years because the law hadn't been passed in 1968, or it was a modified law. So I'm used to dealing with it, and that's just part of my DNA. That's where it comes from. And I'm not retreated, nor do I plan to, on this. I'm somewhat intrigued that you say, of course, the Governor's Committee can now meet and come back and correct any problems, but you've never called a meeting to discuss this in the first place. The fact is,
it was on the agenda for the last governance committee, which was postponed, and then the governor can ask that something be removed from a committee and brought to the full board, where the board acts as a committee of the whole. Well, it can be sent back to the governance committee as well, if that's the board's choice.
Well, the fact is, you've given your answer and you're sticking to it, and I understand that. But the record will reflect, unlike most resolutions that come here, this did not go to governance. It wasn't fully vetted. It wasn't even remotely vetted. In fact, I beg to differ with you. I don't think it was on the last agenda for May 24. I don't remember seeing it. But if I'm wrong about that, that's a minor point, and I step back and withdraw it. But in terms of this meeting, it was never on this board's agenda for today until, in fact, didn't even go out until Wong Tron sent out the email that enclosed the document last Thursday on May 31. No one saw it. Well, I didn't see it, I'll put it that way. Others may have seen it, since obviously the others have been talking to each other and kind of know what they want to do. But secondly, I think it, the record should reflect that as opposed to soliciting and pointing out some of the issues that exist, it just was turned over to the attorney. And frankly, I think there are a couple of issues here that have to be looked at. The first hurdle in this item is the First Amendment. When you're acting as a member of this board, you are also a federal employee for the brief time you're serving here. At least we're paid for that. And the courts have consistently recognized the rights of federal employees to speak openly on matters which may be of public concern. And I think this particular policy can circumvent and weaken that obligation. Secondly, and it's been utterly unmentioned here today, but if in the course of deliberations, and I would hope what I'm about to say would never occur, but it could, and there's not even mentioned, if there were whistleblower protections discussing potential problems or matters of concern within the agency or how the agency should be run, or protected activities. That is, if one came across information, I have a chance meeting with Governor Meehan and I rode on the same plane and had a very enjoyable conversation and didn't discuss business on those topics. But that's a chance meeting, which I assume is covered with two governors. And if I learned something, I never would from Mr. Meehan, so that was illegal or immoral.
Never learn something from me?
Oh, I would learn, but I wouldn't learn something that it was illegal. I learn daily being in your shadow. I can assure you there should be an exemption spelled out for this doesn't infringe upon or even remotely infringe upon whistleblowers. And that's not even mentioned. Now, you can say, well, that's the law, and, of course, we all understand, and that's the case. But it's not here. Also, there are really no standards in this proposed policy. I mean, I think a court would end up throwing this out because it's too broad to give reasonable guidance as to what you're supposed to do. One of the issues with laws against pornography, which I support, by the way, is that they were so broad that the courts could not mow it. Only until Potter Stewart came along and said, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it, did that sort of amorphous standard develop. And I'm just saying here, if you look at it, surely not all information that a staff member says is confidential and pre-decisional is automatically that, and no review. And no review by a single member of the board. But then you say the board can, by resolution, rescind that. But we know the board meets every 5 to 6 weeks, and by that time it's been forgotten or whatever has occurred. There's no statement in here. Who decides what is confidential? No one that we're saying here. And this is why the governance committee should have been meeting. All these could hopefully be spelled out, and you're going to be back here again at some point, either with this board or future board, dealing with everything. Here, you talk about mismanagement or misconduct. Who determines what is mismanaged? Is this board going to meet as a review board and a member of the board violated this policy, and then they're going to, what, pass a resolution saying that's a no-no, send it to the U.S. attorney and ask him to investigate and prosecute? I mean, what is planned? And why are these terms not defined? I mean, you know, the holes in this policy are bigger are big enough for a Mack truck to drive through. I mean, what if a member of Congress, and most of us have friends who are members of Congress whose friendship we value, a number of whom we know about this board, staffers. If they ask me, what about the CEO proposal that Lynn Wiles sent out at Dick Lobo's suggestion or direction about the CEO that originally was going to include the entities and not include the entities, I'm supposed to say, well, Senator, that's pre-decisional and I can't respond. Is that my answer? I don't think so. Not to someone that I grew up with, and we were fellow staff aides on Senator Howard Baker's staff 42 years ago. I think you've gone far more than surely you intended. I would think any member of this board.
Like we lost you.
Are these folks against me? If I were a conspirator, was completely conspiracy theory. I'd say it was planned.
We're back.
Let me continue.
Musical interlude.
Oh, were you prohibited from discussing with a senator or a senior staff aide on House appropriations or Senate appropriations? This, am I prohibited from talking to a fellow attorney? Is the only attorney I can talk to the deputy legal counsel here, with whom I may have an honest and professional disagreement, but we just aren't on the same wavelength?
If I could interject.
Okay, Governor McHugh.
Just because it seems to me, I think that the goal of this policy is to allow for the governors and staff to have pre-decisional conversations and not have those conversations intentionally or not misrepresented to the press, and not to have inaccurate information or partial information get out that's misleading. That seems to be our goal here, not to suppress any information. I'm not for that at all, Governor Ash. I agree with you on those points. So maybe if we can focus on what the goal of this is,
Governor McHugh, no one respects or likes you more than I do. And we may differ, but that doesn't diminish the relationship that we have and my friendship for you. But this does far more than your stated statement, in my opinion. There are others who might disagree with me, but it goes far beyond that, and I think it'll be back here in that. Let me just quickly sort of finish up, because I know everyone's anxious to go do something else. But in terms of information, I think Justice Louis Brandeis probably explained it well, and this comes from The Economist of May 26 to June 1 issue, where they discussed the president's transparency, and the headline is "The Best Disinfectant," and it gives the president good marks on supporting transparency, but also feels that he has not gotten good remarks on protecting whistleblowers in the column. And but this comes at a time when I would point out whistleblowers in the year 2010. 77% of the $3.1 billion that America won in fraud-related judgments and settlements came from suits brought by whistleblowers. That could be either in the private or public sector. So I think whistleblowers, as uncomfortable and as unpleasant as it may be for the people having the whistle blown on them, is an important part of American society and is protected by federal law. But nowhere in this do we reference that and even salute and nod our hat and saying, yes, protecting whistleblowers is something we don't mean to even remotely infringe upon, and this doesn't even do that. But let me conclude by saying, sunlight, this is Justice Louis Brandeis from Massachusetts, a Supreme Court justice nearly a century ago, is said to be the best of disinfectants. That is, unless it's national security, letting the sun shine in, I think is important, and you know, when we're talking about how a piece of legislation on the CEO is drafted, I don't consider that foreign policy. I consider that institutional policy as to what would be best, and there's no reason, since it involves, and this board is not a private board. This isn't the Kiwanis Club. This isn't a private board like Brown Shoe Company. This is a public body of members appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, and should be considered that way. I think, you know, oftentimes, for example, the way, and I fondly disagree with this, and this is one reason I think that this is a mistake, is that this board has not had a serious debate, in my view, and there are members here who disagree with me, on what the CEO position should be, and whether or not we should go forward with it. An email was sent out directed by Mr. Lobo doing a straw poll on whether a majority of the board wanted to proceed with it or not proceed. There's no doubt in my mind the majority supported proceeding. I was one who did not. I thought, frankly, the straw poll, and again my personal opinion, was in effect a notational vote under another name. that it was camouflaged cleverly, but also inappropriately. And that there, and while the board could have met and arrived at the same decision, there at least would have been a discussion and a dialogue, just as we're having right now. And I'm under no illusions what the final vote's going to be, but we have spent about 40 minutes now discussing what we think the pros and cons of this protocol are. And I think that's, thank goodness we are doing that. And that's important. But I think, you know, I have a higher responsibility to inform members of Congress of concerns that I might have when I disagree with proposed policy. And I don't feel I have to wait until this board has decided to say, now you can, it's free to talk about, and it may be after the fact. I think the process of the consideration of the House and Senate committees, and when we have staff that will go up there to represent a majority view of the board, that also all the documents ought to be able to go with them. And I think that is not being done here, and that represents a step back. I can assure you that when this motion is adopted, I will follow my conscience in terms of what should be done. And I just let everyone know I don't want anyone to be misled as to my attitude on it, because it's a matter of deep principle with me that staff should not be able to just take the stamp out and put classified, confidential, pre-decisional, and no member of this board. Now, if the board voted to make something confidential, I have a different attitude towards it. But when, in effect, we are delegating non-delegable authorities, and because our attorney says you'll do it, but, you know, that doesn't mean you can do it. It's just what he said.
So can I interrupt there again then with a process question, Governor Mulhall? Can this language reflect the board deciding what is deliberative?
What'd she say?
She wants to know if the language could reflect that the board can decide what is deliberative.
Sure, you make that amendment.
Go ahead, Paul.
That would resolve a lot of my issues.
I was going to say, I mean, in effect, that's that's what the board would be doing if it decides.
Can you talk into the mic?
Yes. That, Governor McHugh, that in effect is what the board would be doing if it votes for a policy with a definition of deliberative information in it. You're deciding what categories of information fall into that category.
Governor McHugh, in all deference to Mr. Comer, I respectfully disagree. And the email that went out that excluded the entity heads and David Enzer, which I forwarded, in contrary to Lynn Wiles' comment in the email that was apparently said in Dick Lobo's direction, that I did forward to the entity heads as well as to David Enzer and to Carlos Garcia, said, you know, it's pre-decisional, whatever. Well, no one on this board made that decision to exclude these people. Not a single board. That was made either by my good friend Mr. Lobo or by someone else. Not that he did it out of malice. I don't think he ever did. I don't know who did it, but I know one thing. It wasn't the board, and why should I be obligated to do what a staff member might sincerely want me to do, but I don't agree with.
Governor Meehan.
Thank you. I share your frustration that the United States Congress in its decision to in 1994 to create this board in 1998 to make some amendments hadn't thought through all of the things that go on, and your commitment as we do to invest a lot of your personal time and energy into the success of the board. But I also know that we should make efforts to address that. I struggle with some of your remarks in the following way. We have national security clearance. There are issues here that are related there. And if someone turned those over, I personally would be in trouble for that. There's a law against that. And we accept that when we accepted these posts, that there is absolutely some information that cannot be shared beyond the board. And so what I think this resolution is trying to set up a path that says that there is information that can be shared and there's information that's not. And if a member of the board gets the majority of the board to agree with them to make it public, we should make it public. I just think it's a question of of functionality. You can't walk into a crowded movie house and scream fire because you have First Amendment speech protections. So I don't see anything that we discussed that fall into that. I completely agree with you on whistleblower. If there was a document that came through that showed that, I think that there's a place for this board to deal with that, and we have the power to deal with that. So I'd accept your on that. That's for sure. What I struggle with, though, is, you know, I actually struggle with how you enforce this as well. But I think this board can come up with its guidelines on how to deal with information and create an environment where we can have an honest conversation. I don't think I can go to my friend Senator Kerry and say that Governor Ash said X when you really said Y. That's what we're trying to prevent from happening here, is people being ascribed with positions that aren't accurate. And I think that's what Governor McHugh is saying. I want to find a way that doesn't happen. I'm perfectly comfortable with you going telling your friends on the Capitol Hill that Meehan opposes the CEO or Meehan's for the CEO, as long as it's what I said. What I oppose happening is the characterization of private board deliberations before we make a decision. And I think we need some self-policing on this. And I think the Congress allows us to self-police on this. I don't think you need to change the law or rewrite a law to have self-policing of the board. And the ability to have a vote happen, and I can lose 8-1 on my self-policing, right? But at least I get the presumption of be self-policed. That's why I support it.
Any further comments or questions?
I just would like to know if this is a legal proposal or the spirit of a policy proposal, because it does, in my case, since I have to report back to the secretary on what I'm representing, I do want to be clear whether this is legal language or just policy guidance, which I think is important here.
Okay, well, I think that's actually a great and perceptive question. I mean, these are ground rules that the board is imposing on themselves.
It's a policy.
I mean, you would be agreeing as a board to impose these rules on yourself. This is not something you're imposing on the public. It's not something you're imposing on anyone else. The governors are agreeing to abide by this set of rules. If I may, both the Supreme Court and the President of the United States, according to Governor Mohop's introductory remarks, both acknowledge that there is a space, you know, for this type of protection of information, of deliberative process. So I'm not seeing any inconsistency with the First Amendment, since the Supreme Court probably knows something about the First Amendment, and it did, in fact, acknowledge that this is not a problem. And as far as whistleblowing is concerned, if I may, whistleblowing has a very specific meaning. It means reporting wrongdoing to a law enforcement body. It doesn't mean disclosing something to the press or something like that. So I would find it difficult, if it was surprising myself, if someone were to actually engage in whistleblowing and then the board decided that it wanted to punish that governor or punish that staff member for having done that.
But we could put in this policy that nothing in this policy affects any rights, ability to whistleblow, have any effect on whistleblowing protections or something to that effect, right?
Or we could just say it should be interpreted not Chairman.
Only-
I'm sorry, we can't hear you here in Washington.
There you go. I move it be amended to say that nothing in this protocol shall negatively impact the Federal Whistleblowers Act by a member of the board or employee of BBG. That's my motion.
Okay, that's a motion.
I second.
Wait, Mr. Colmer, do you have it written down?
No.
I want
no,
to make sure you have it written
let's
down.
Let's make sure that we...
As phrased. Or you can replay the tape.
You know, I think I'll replay the tape because I'd like to make sure I've got the name of the statute correct and probably the legal citation
I didn't
as well.
Put that in the statute. I just said whistleblower statute. But if you want
yeah,
to
Yeah, I mean, I think we'd
fine.
Have to do that. If that's the board's wish, that if we're referring to a specific statute, that we actually get the name of the statute and the citation correct.
Well, I think the intention is, and however it's worded, is that we want to be clear that nothing in this affects any ability or any rights of a whistleblower or protections of a whistleblower. So whatever language is appropriate to memorialize our intention in that respect. Is that what I'm hearing from you,
no.
Governor Ash?
On this issue, I think the board agrees.
Right. So we have a – are you okay with that, Paul? Okay. So we have a – it's been moved and
– I have a press. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Vote on that.
No.
I have a question. of do we need, and I support Governor Ash and Governor Meehan on that amendment, but should we insert language? Should we insert language saying deliberative information as determined by the board?
Well, can we finish? Can we finish? Let's finish. We have a motion that's been made and seconded, amending with regard to whistleblower. So, is there further discussion? All those in favor of that amendment, say aye. Aye.
So
opposed. So
amendment
to.
One has been adopted.
That's agreed to.
And Governor McHugh apparently has a question about the potential amendment.
To Governor McHugh.
Do we need the clarification of deliberative information is to be determined by the board? Paul?
I'm not sure I know what the implications of that are.
Saying that that's implied?
Well, I'm saying that it's established by this policy. You're establishing what constitutes the categories of information that are protected by the policy. By adopting a policy with a definition of deliberative information, you could expand that by saying, you know, information that's expressly determined by the board to be deliberative.
I don't think it's addressing what Governor Ash actually has correctly raised, which is that this is for board guidance. This is not to affect public. I mean, I do think it's important that I've clarified that this is to provide the board with the spirit of openness and deliberation, not to restrict. So somewhere I do think it's important to make it clear that this is to enable the board to deliberate more candidly and openly, not to restrict public discussion. So I think that is sort of what, however you deem it, this is about the board policing itself and enabling it to do its job better for the public. I think that's what the governor was saying.
Why don't we put in here, Governor Meehan, that pre-decisional deliberative as approved by the board, approved or disapproved?
I'd support that, but my understanding, and I'm not a lawyer, but is that the OMB has given the BBG clear guidance on what is pre-decisional and can be talked about ahead of time
with respect to the budget.
With respect to the budget, right? So let's just take them one at a time. So on the matters before the budget, I don't believe that this board can have a vote to overturn the rules of the OMB. I'm not a lawyer, but that's been my operational understanding.
I'm sure that's the case.
That is the case.
Get briefed on what we documents here. I'm sorry.
There you go.
My mistake. We don't. Thank you. We don't have any of the actual written language that would give us guidance, which I think we've always assumed this, but until you see the written word, you don't necessarily know if there's wiggle room or not wiggle room and on that. It seems to me, I just go back to Governor Meehan, we thought we'd given clear guidance on Burma, and then apparently what we thought was clear guidance was less than clear. And I would say here, I think a majority of you feel like you're giving clear guidance to staff, but staff is going to be the one that has the rubber stamp that will say confidential, pre-decisional, and only by majority of the board 6 weeks later, meeting as a board or doing a phone call or whatever it is, notational vote, which has to be unanimous, can you undo it? And I think that's a pretty serious thing. And, you know, the issues I've been talking about, frankly, are the CEO proposal, whether it affects entities, doesn't affect entities. That's a valid debate that is not foreign policy. It's not national security. And whether or not we would make a proposal or not. I guess OMB signed off on it because Lynn's up on the Hill frequently pushing it, so I assume she wouldn't do it in violation of OMB.
Okay.
We need to bring this to a conclusion now. So
My question is, there are many times when the board directs the IBB director and by extension staff to prepare documents for the board's further consideration and deliberation. For example, you did in January ask us to prepare drafts of the International Broadcasting Innovation Act, You've asked us to look into how to structure a CEO. You've asked us to look into all sorts of things. So what you're saying is, if I understand it correctly, the board would then have to first consider it and then decide that it's pre-decisional before it would be subject to this policy. And it seems to me that the way that the board is intending for this to work, if I'm correct, is that once the board has instructed the staff to go and develop the information or the proposal or the options or whatever, that they should be subject to this policy and be deemed to be subject to it. And then after the board has actually seen it, then the board can decide, it's not a pre-decision, we want the whole world to be able to see it. I mean, this happens almost every, there are many meetings when, we prepare something and there is a question about, well, who decided to put confidential on top of this piece of paper? And so it's an important
question. Which I never got an answer. I mean, I emailed you 6 days ago on this proposal saying, where did this come from? What are the reasons behind it? And you determined, for whatever reason, not to respond to my email. So I don't have a way of, if you're not going to respond, I can't make up an answer for you.
I didn't receive your email, otherwise I would have responded.
Are we prepared to proceed on this?
Well, no, we need some language amended per Undersecretary Sonenshine, which is important. So how can we add that language and then come back to it? I agree with her.
You can move it down 15 minutes because we're going to be meeting more 15 minutes.
Right, you Paul, can take the time now to offer to draft the amendment and offer it, and then we can come
do
back
other
to
business
it because we do have other resolutions to act upon.
Okay, do you
understand? How you phrase it.
I mean, I'm not sure I understand what it is that we're trying to achieve here. Do you?
I do.
Okay, I'm just asking. Okay, but I don't understand what the amendment is. So,
I was looking for a way, Frank. I was looking for a way, frankly, that we could all be in agreement on, if I understood Governor Ash's concern, that this is board self-regulation. This is not to impede upon anyone's ability in a congressional meeting or otherwise. So, to be honest, I would prefer that this be something we all sign up to, or I don't think it's going to be very enforceable. I mean, my honest response is if we can find a way for this to be a consensus, since it's board-driven, board-executed, and board-monitored, and board-implemented, it's very difficult if we have this as a divisive issue to then go out truly in a spirit of cooperation. So my intent was to not introduce something to complicate it, but to see if the governor might have something that we could all sign up to.
Well, Secretary Sonenshine, I can give you my pledge that I'm willing to work with you and any others. I don't see how we do it in 10 minutes, but if you all want a special call meeting by phone in 2 weeks, that's fine with me, too. I think we can come up with the right word language, which would go a long ways to solving the deep-felt concerns that I have. But, I just sort of assumed by the way it was handled and the absence of a committee meeting that, a majority clearly wanted to do what they wanted to do, and other than give a great speech, I wasn't going to do much to slow it down, and it'd just be a 7-1 vote. And if it is, excuse me, 6-1 vote. And if it is, it is. But obviously, as you can tell from, I've tried to be professional and be polite, but I've also been very direct and very candid in where I'm coming from. And, yes, I will openly say I think the board made a terrible mistake. I hope they'll reconsider. I hope the Hill, frankly, when they give us micromanaging, will micromanage this out of the of our proceedings. But I may not succeed
at that. Victor, this is Michael. Let me ask you a question, honestly. Honest. I need a really honest answer. Do we have a problem right now with leaks coming out of the various meetings we're having at the BBG, yes or no?
No question about it. And some
correct.
Come
that,
of the private
do you
meeting.
Do you believe that problem needs to be addressed?
Yes, but this doesn't do it.
Well, this goes a lot further toward doing it than anything that's been happening to date.
Right. Well,
and unless we put some policy in place, and I'm perfectly happy to modify the one on the table, there is no way that we're going to be able to stop the leaks. Because to Michael Meehan's point before, normally in any other situation when somebody leaks, they would be asked, they would be dismissed out of hand, and we can't do that here.
You can't do it in any public agency. It's totally different from the private sector. And a state agency, you can. Maybe you can the federal.
So we lost sound again.
No, I forgot to hit the button. I'm sorry. Oh. You could completely be fired in any government agency for leaving. It's just because we're an independent board. We have to have a self-policing mechanism, and I completely agree with Undersecretary that it'd be much more reasonable if Governor Ash found a way to address this that you're comfortable with. I would be much more comfortable with a unanimous vote about dealing with this and addressing your concerns.
And I'm saying
having a 6-1. So I would love to figure out a way to get there.
And I don't know how we do it in 5 minutes or move it down, and you and I huddle. Between the two of us, you move it off one. I mean, if this is deferred 10 days, big deal. I mean,
I accept. So let's move it down, and then you and I can go huddle and see if we can bring something back.
Okay. Well, you have to make a motion. Well, you all can go on with other items.
Okay, so we'll see how that goes. So you guys can see what you come up with. We
have a numbers problem. If you and I leave, then we don't have a quorum, so they actually can't vote on the next thing.
We don't have any items to vote on, I don't think.
Yes, we do. We have
We have some resolutions. Well, you'll be back for those, won't you?
Well,
then maybe.
You want a 10-minute recess for Mike
to
wait for what?
I think we should. We have the only thing that we have that requires board votes is the resolution. So.
Well, we have the travel one, which I've accepted Michael's proposal.
Okay.
Let's move on
to
Mary Jean and switch it up.
No. We're going to do action items, not reports. So you don't have an action item, Mary Jean, do you?
No, just a report.
No. So we're not doing the reports right this moment. Right now, we're doing action items. So, you're on your travel policy.
I'd be glad to make a blanket motion that we approve the resolution for Enders Wimbush and the travel as modified by Governor Meehan. And isn't that it?
Well, if that is acceptable to the board, do you guys hear that in Washington?
Yes,
that's great.
We agree.
Okay. Well, then can we say by concurrence we agree to the travel policy as amended, relative, as I understand it, that it excludes travel, but it relates to conferences.
Except the conference, and on the matter of the travel, while we agree with the spirit of saving money, that we would go to the practical application and let the governance committee decide.
And right. I would move the adoption of that resolution as amended by Governor Meehan's statement, as well as the congratulatory resolution under Wimbush.
Okay.
So it's a two-part motion. I'm not asking that the question be divided.
Okay, fine. There's a motion and a second for those two things. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Opposed. That motion's agreed to. So now we would gratefully ask.
I move that we stand in a 7-minute recess.
Okay, we'll stand in a 7-minute recess. Well, you guys can finish your work in 7 minutes.
Well, we'll finish it one way or the other.
Okay. I think
all right, let's go ahead then with the audio of tell us what you've come up with.
Well, on behalf of Governor Ash and myself, we propose an amendment as follows, and Paul Comer-Dorsey joined us to write it. You want to say it, and then we can make sure that we got. I will try to give.
Yes.
I will give try to give voice to this. So the first part would be to modify the definition of deliberative information. To say that it's to create two specific categories of deliberative information. It means any non-public information, either tangible records or otherwise, exchanged between two or more governors or between staff members and governors, which pertain to budgetary matters that are determined to be pre-decisional under current OMB guidelines. Oh, okay. Oh, that's okay.
No. And two, legislative proposals that are developed for the consideration of the board that are determined by the chairman or acting chairman to be predecisional, subject to the board's further review.
Just a point of clarification on that. So on when the board directs the staff to propose legislation at our direction, that the chairman or the acting chairman determines whether that information is confidential or not. If the chairman or acting chairman determines that information is confidential, the board can act upon it to make it unconfidential, but it is presumed to be confidential until then. If the acting chairman says that information is not confidential, it remains not confidential. So that would deal with legislative proposals and recommendations from the staff to the board, but the acting chairman or chairman has that. And then on the third, on the last bucket, if there are other categories that haven't been decided, we ask that the governance committee meet and discuss them and bring a recommendation back to the full board about other categories of information.
So three buckets. Two are full and one's empty. All right. Is that it?
Yeah. And well, my one question is, on the third category. On the third category, so we would just create a number three, such other matters that are recommended, determined by the board upon recommendation. That can be a second.
Governor Ash, we can't hear you.
All right. The proposal that Governor Meehan and I made was that the, you know, we only had 7 minutes, it became 20. And it's foolish to stand between this board and dinner. And so, therefore, what we couldn't figure out in the limited time, we basically said between now and July, there'll be a governance meeting. Our request is, and I'm not the chairman, is that the governance committee meet, go over bucket three, which may turn out to be zero or may turn out to be, upon further reflection, a couple of serious questions that need to be dealt with. And that's all. It was unfinished business that we couldn't finish in what time is left.
Okay. I mean,
is that fair?
Is that
so? I would.
I move.
I will call the question on Amendment 2 to the main motion.
Any further conversation or questions about it? So this is Amendment 2, moved by Governor Ash, seconded by Governor Meehan.
The reverse.
Oh, okay. Sorry. The other way around. Moved by Governor Meehan, seconded by Governor Ash. With those amendments as outlined, is everybody clear what we're voting on? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, it's apparently unanimously agreed to.
Now we're back on the main question.
Now moving to the right.
All right, let me say this and wrap up. First of all, I appreciate the manner in which the board has considered the matter, knowing individually there are a number of strong differences, some of which can be bridged, some of which may not be bridged, but was handled, I think, in a professional way. And I particularly appreciate Governor Meehan's efforts and the other four board members bearing with him to let it be worked out. And we were able to work it out, and then we had Mr. Comer reduce it to writing. I did say and was very open about it that I'm voting for this now. I think it's a vast improvement over what was presented. But if by practice and implementation or by further reflection and review and, frankly, getting public comments from people who've heard the debate, other issues come up, I certainly will advocate that they be resolved and will be considered by the board. And if they're not, then obviously I'll be a strong opponent, what's happened. But I'm assuming there will, frankly, be some additional issues that somebody will dream up. They may not be major issues, but they'll be issues. And in terms of wrapping the package together, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, and getting it as right as we could, that's why I go back to, I wish the governor's committee met the first time, but that's water under the bridge. I can't undo it. But we're going to meet, even if that's the only reason we meet.
No, I'm sure there are other reasons. Okay, thank you. On the main motion then, does someone move for the adoption of the protocol on confidentiality?
I do.
Governor Meehan moves. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Second by Governor McHugh. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's agreed to unanimously. Okay. Thank you very much on that one. What is the
you wouldn't have put $5 on that at 1 o'clock today, would you?
Probably not a lot, no.
Maybe even one check crowd.
So what's the pleasure of the board? It's now, well, we don't have much option, I think. We're due at the ambassador's house at some point.
So I do need to have the Middle East Broadcasting Network meet for 5 minutes. So if and we do need a quorum. We need a quorum. So if we can quickly pivot, I promise it'll be a short, fast meeting. But with Wimbush's
there's a movement for adjournment.
Lobo will give me the memo.
Any disagreement? Labor. Okay, the Broadcasting Board of Governors meeting is adjourned.
Thank you. No, don't. I need
don't
somebody
leave.
To stay.
Michael. Staying.
Oh,
you're
for
law.
Susan's staying.
Susan's here.
I'm here.
And
okay.
Dennis
Michael
or Dick, perhaps the reports that we didn't get, we could get in writing.
I'll be happy to do that with mine.
Is Michael Lentz still there?